This episode is brought to you by Odd Mo's Pizza in Canby. Handmade awesome pizza plus craft beer, cider, and wine delivered. Call them today at 503-266-8444.
This episode is also brought to you by the Canby Liquor Store. Father's Day is coming, and they really have everything that your dad really wants. From hand-selected gifts you won't find anywhere else, to small batch bourbons and unique craft beers. Find them in the Fred Meyer Shopping Center. Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Around 100 people gathered in Waite Park Saturday afternoon for a Canby Backs the Blue event held to show support and appreciation for law enforcement in general and the Canby Police Department in particular. Canby Mayor Brian Hodson opened the event with prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance before remarks by organizer Shannon Wernecki, her mother Jean Bremer, and three candidates for the Canby City Council, Tracy Hensley, Jordan Tibbles, and James Heeb. After about 30 minutes, the group moved to 99E, where they lined both sides of the road between Grant and Elm. They waved American flags, some with blue or red line in support of the first responders, as well as banners supporting the re-election of President Donald Trump. Few, fortunately, have ever experienced as serious a need for the police as Bremer, Wernecki, and her family. Bremer's brother and sister-in-law were two of the victims in the quadruple homicide by Mark Gago at his home on South Barlow Road in January 2019.
Part of our family was murdered and patched up, and it was all over the news, and this was Mark Gago that did it. And I thank our police officers, our state police, that came out and helped their family and was part of this. They saw some just horrific things that they won't even let me know about. I've heard some awful things of what has happened, but I just thank them that they're willing to go to these awful, awful scenarios all the time, because that's where their lives are. They love our people.
Canby police did not attend the event in person, though several patrol cars cruised by afterwards with lights flashing for a brief impromptu parade, to much applause from the crowd. Chief Brett Smith declined an invitation to speak, but drafted a brief statement thanking the community for its support, which Wernicke read from the gazebo steps.
So where is this country going? I know in lieu of the election, this is a very controversial time we have in all of our lives. Today is not about politics, it's a simple support gathering for our first responders. Time and time again, our law enforcement saves so many lives. Current events have shown how people are brainwashed into believing because one person makes a mistake, the whole group must be bad, which is not true. It breaks my heart and scared for my kids' future how much people push for defunding law enforcement and then turn right back around and shout, call 911 when they need help.
Tibbles and Heeb both spoke to the situation in downtown Portland, where peaceful Black Lives Matter protests have been followed on an almost nightly basis by violent riots, at which both police and demonstrators have been injured, sometimes seriously, and attempts have been made to burn down the public justice buildings.
What we as citizens and leaders of Canby recognize that our Portland neighbors have forgotten is that these police officers are human beings, same as you and me. They have children, their moms, dads, brothers, sisters of their own, and they deserve to come back home to those individuals.
Yes.
When you tie their hands behind their back and allow anarchy and riots to run your streets and go unpunished by the district attorney, you're creating an environment that disregards the safety of our officers and the value of their life.
Russ and Tish Wallbaum of Canby were among the group that attended the event in Waite Park, then walked to 99E afterwards. They were there to support their son, Canby Police Detective Nate Wallbaum, and other law enforcement. It's tough to know that he's going out there, not knowing what he's going to come up against, Tish said. But we're Christians, so we pray for him and we trust God. And we know he's always in good hands, and he's got his partners to back him up. After most of the participants had proceeded to 99E, a smaller group of Canby High School students and young people assembled at the park for an impromptu Black Lives Matter demonstration. The students were incensed by their perception that the group's Blue Lives Matter message was being equated to Black Lives Matter. Being a police officer is voluntary, a uniform that can be taken off at the end of the day, they said. Being black cannot. They carried signs and banners and chatted respectfully with several people from the Back the Blue event, including Keeb and his mother, Gina, who spent most an hour in polite dialogue with the group. Proud of my friends and the peaceful conversations we had, said one of the teens afterwards. Proud of the people who stopped and listened to our points, even when they disagreed with us. Not proud of the people who justify their racism because we know black people. Not proud of the people who ignore me and my mixed race sister. For photos and video, find the story on our website, canbyfirst.com. Outgoing Clackamas County Chair Jim Bernard issued a statement Thursday condemning and denouncing white supremacy. The extremist ideology and those who hold it, which the Federal Bureau of Investigation regards as one of the United States' most serious domestic threats, became a national talking point after ambiguous statements President Donald Trump made during the first presidential debate last week. The president's comments concern the Proud Boys, which law enforcement and civil rights groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center associate with white nationalist ideals, though many of the group's members dispute this. Asked to denounce white supremacy in general and tell the Proud Boys in particular to stand down, President Trump instead said, "Stand back and stand by." Words the group received enthusiastically and even began merchandising. Later in the week, the president unequivocally condemned white supremacists, specifically referring to such groups as the Proud Boys and the Ku Klux Klan. "Our current political dialogue seems to leave the door open to white supremacy," Bernard said in the statement, which did not mention Trump or other person or group by name. "We want to go on record very clearly. That door is firmly closed in our county." While remarking on the cracks, man-made and otherwise, the global pandemic and historic wildfires have brought into greater focus this year, Bernard offered hope. "We have the ability, however, to change our future, our own education, and action," he said. He and the four other elected commissioners of Clackamas County represent different ideologies, different points of view, and different opinions. Bernard said, "Yet, we come to our work each day with a commitment to work together to advance and improve the quality of life for all of our residents. We have spoken out together about racial injustice in our county and in our world," he said. "We are working to eradicate it and to truly value every individual who calls Clackamas County home so that all of its residents may thrive." Bernard's re-election bid was defeated outright in the May primary by challenger and former Clackamas County Commissioner Tootie Smith. Dozens of parents took to the street along Southeast 82nd near Clackamas Town Center Thursday to rally for schools to safely open. Parents and students waved homemade signs bearing slogans such as "Kids Deserve Better," "Let us go to school," and "We can safely open." At times they chanted, "Clack to school." The name of the group that organized the rally, which was founded by local moms just a few weeks ago. Among the attendees was Canby mother Brooke Toma, who was there with her Baker Prairie Middle School 7th grader. It was important for me to show up, she told Now Hear This Canby. Thomas says she believes the Canby School District is doing a great job under the circumstances, but she and many of the parents behind Clack to School think the state's coronavirus guidelines for reopening the schools have been set needlessly high. We are trying to send a message to the governor that the metrics to return to school are nearly unattainable, Thomas says. And I feel that Zoom school is unequitable, unsustainable, and unacceptable. It is cumbersome and lackluster. Kids need hands-on learning to seek their full potential, she says, and she worries the consequences from this era of distant learning will linger long after the coronavirus is a thing of the past. Clack to School stresses that their goal is to reopen schools safely in a hybrid model that still allows for limiting the size of classes and the number of students in a school building at any one time. They also want in-person instruction to remain an option, not a mandate for students and parents who are uncomfortable with it. We want to have choices, Thomas says. Physical isolation is detrimental to mental health, and many kids need the extra supports that are readily available in school building. The current coronavirus metrics for reintroducing students to classrooms would require counties to have seen 10 or fewer cases, new cases, of COVID-19 per 100,000 people over 7 days for 3 weeks in a row. The test positivity of 5% or less in both the county and state for the same period. Though the COVID-19 outlook has improved somewhat since June, schools in Clackamas County remain nowhere particularly close to meeting those numbers. After a low of 20.5 cases per 100,000 residents in the first week of September, Clackamas County's weekly caseload is back up to the 35 range, where it has been for most of the summer. As of this week, Clackamas County still does not meet the metrics required to return to our buildings, Canby School District Superintendent Trip Goodall said in a newsletter to families. We are just as eager as you are to return to in-person learning, but must follow these metrics and take care of precautions so that we can get back to our schools safely. Asked about the rally this week, the Oregon Department of Education provided media outlets a statement saying they are currently, quote, no conversations about changing metrics. Families have the right to voice their opinion, and ODE knows this is a challenging time for students and families, the department says. ODE and the Oregon Health Authority are partnering to resolve challenges, review best practices, and support education and health leaders across the state. The kinds of disruption and impacts families and kids are experiencing are a real impact of responding to COVID-19, ODE said. We will be the first ones cheering to see the metrics come back down in counties across Oregon. A grand opening event has been set for Aurora's newest business, which is also one of its most unique. A salon, gift shop, and art gallery, all combined into one. The event will be held at noon on October 11th at Blue Alley Salon Gifts and Galleria, located next to Pheasant Run Winery at the end of Main Street in historic downtown Aurora. The name was inspired by the alley the salon shares with Pheasant Run, known as the Blue Bucket Alley, after one of Aurora's great mystery writers, whose work is memorialized there. Owner Ann Ashlyn Wayne grew up on the family farm east of Woodburn, but has a special connection to Aurora. Her parents' first date was at a restaurant there 65 years ago. I'm thrilled beyond my expectations to be a part of this friendly, stylish little community, she says. The salon offers spa-style manicures, pedicures, hair styling, cuts, and color. The gift shop features locally made products, including soaps, jewelry, and t-shirts, while the Galleria will showcase selections from local artists. Wayne is a veteran hairstylist of over 30 years. Longtime clients of hers say her work is not just a haircut, it's an experience. Call to set up an appointment at 503-267-3969. That's 503-267-3969. Or check them out on Facebook.
Hey, Frankie, you okay? You seem kind of down.
Yeah, just bummed.
miss going to the wild hair. I know you can still get takeout and all, but it's just not the same.
You know they're open again, right?
What?
Yeah, they've been open for a while now. Don't you cover, like, the news?
Hey, I'm only human, okay?
Okay. Well, I can tell you that the Wild Hare and their amazing staff are thrilled to be open again for delicious meals and fun times. They are strictly following all the recommended safety guidelines, and they have the only covered outdoor patio in Canby, with lots of tables spaced 6 feet apart and umbrellas also spaced 6 feet apart and fantastic ambiance. And hey, if you're still more comfortable with carryout, they can hook you up there too. Find their menu and other information online at thewildhairsaloon.net or check them out in Canby in Oregon City. Anything to add, Frankie? Frankie? Oh, I guess he left. God, he must have been really hungry.
The Canby conversation today, we're coming at you from the firehouse to tell a story that out of the wildfires of last month, so many cool stories came out, but I feel like this is one that really hasn't been told all that well. Maybe not fully at all. We're at the Colton Fire District with Chris Cohoon of Colton Fire.
Yep.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
Good. A lieutenant, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Welcome on to Now Hear This, Canby.
Thank you.
And this little, almost entirely volunteer fire district, you just had the paid chief and, you know, some administrative type staff just being surrounded basically at one point with level 3 evacuation zones and literal wildland fires just encroaching all around you. And just what was that like? What were those first couple of weeks like for you guys?
So we had guys on three engines, two water tenders, running 24 hours for the first full five days,
and
hard.
It was just you. I mean, there was no support early on.
Yeah,
right?
So early on, it was Colton, Malala, Clackamas, kind of that Labor Day night.
Okay, yeah.
Labor Day.
Night, yeah.
So Labor Day afternoon, kind of it all broke loose, and so everybody was pretty stretched. We started off that afternoon on the mill fire, and then had another couple little small fires, and then we had the Younger Road fire, which ended up burning 500 acres up just on the backside of our fire district. It kind of burned down into us. And then the Riverside fire, the big one, came up on the other side of our fire district. So it was a lot of hours by a lot of good people that... I know for me specifically, I took the week off of work. And then I know a lot of the other guys took their week off and didn't get paid. And they don't get paid for being here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Back to that first day, that first afternoon, I mean, did you guys have any sense? Or when did it kind of hit you that this is like something we've never seen before?
I think late Monday night. But we had heard the weather forecast.
Right.
And kind of put out
the high winds.
Right. Yeah. So we put out a call for duty op for people to come in and pull hours at the station. So we kind of have a group made up of in-district volunteers and out-of-district volunteers.
Okay.
And so if you're an out-of-district volunteer, you have to meet hour requirements per month. And so we kind of sent out a page to everybody as kind of a all call. So, hey, let's staff an engine and a brush truck. We know it's coming.
Yeah.
And it's kind of this big wind event they were calling for. And so we staffed up an engine and a brush truck that afternoon, kind of preparing for it.
Right.
And then...
good thing.
Just everything just kind of exploded. In 21 years, I've never seen anything like that.
And what did that feel like? I mean, what was that experience like of just knowing that this was something unlike you had seen before? How did you handle that? Or was it just reaction?
A lot of it was reaction. So the first couple nights we kind of divided up into task forces with all the neighboring districts. But it, a lot of helplessness, just not being ever in that kind of a situation. Usually in a house fire, it's a box. We can contain it. We can contain it in a box. We know, For the most part, what we need to do to take care of that box.
Yeah.
This was fire coming from two or three different sides, and and it was running from house to house to house, trying to save houses as we went down the road, really.
Mm-hmm. And what were you doing, just trying to spray them?
Yeah, so the task force leaders who, with Clackamas, had some knowledge in the wildland game, more so than just the engine guys. So they were kind of directing traffic out there with they would have three or four engine companies and a couple water tenders on each task force. And so they would kind of be telling you, hey, we want this to burn this way, so we're not going to put this one out, but we want to protect this.
Gotcha.
So we're spraying houses with water and foam, trying to
chess game a little
bit. Yep. So it is very much so a chess game. It's a good way to put it. But so we're just covering houses with water and foam to give it that extra layer of cooling effect, and then to try and keep the embers off of the houses.
Yeah. Were there times that you felt like you were in danger or worse?
I don't know if I felt any more so than I have in the past. It was definitely a different type of eye-opening experience, I guess. It was something I've never seen like that, being right up in the middle of it like that the first couple nights.
Well, I'm really interested in coming back to the experience of this as a volunteer fire district and as volunteers. Let's talk a little bit more about that. You mentioned, you and quite a few other guys kind of took off work and just like, this is what I'm doing. I'm not getting paid. Why?
It's what we love to do.
Yeah.
So a lot of us don't, there is a handful that don't live in this community, but we love this community. It's just, it's a great little place. So it comes back to the drive to want to help people. And I've never felt in my career doing this that I needed that paycheck to justify something. We all go through the same training that any department in the state goes through. We all have to be certified by the state. And so we put those hours in on our own without getting any kind of pay or anything, but the satisfaction of doing the job and helping people.
And that's interesting. We did few episodes ago, interview with Wayne Austin of Canby Fire. I don't know if you know him, but he's the longtime volunteer, and now now it's a division of Canby Fire, the volunteer division chief. And it was interesting talking to him about how the profile for Canby Fire, how the profile of a volunteer has differed over the years. He's been there 50 years.
He just got his 50 year.
Yeah. So he's seen some changes from when he first started, where it was a lot of business people, and they'd hear the siren and they'd close the shop, put a little sign on the door, like, I'm out fighting a fire. Whereas now it's a lot of young people that are, volunteers, but planning to make it a career.
We have a really good mix of both of that.
Okay, cool.
So we do still have a siren on the station.
Yeah.
We have a couple people that worked for the school district, and so they're able to leave the school district during the daytime. So we do have people,
of COVID or even normally?
No, just normally. Yeah. So they're maintenance guys at the school.
Oh, gotcha.
And they're able, they have that.
Not teachers.
No.
Yeah.
So they have that worked out with the school where if it's something that needs more people, they're able to do that. So we have somebody on staff 24 hours a day here, at least one person.
Gotcha.
And then we have some retirees that drive for us or do the engineering for some of our engines. And then we do have a good group of younger people that want to push into a career aspect of it. So they come in, get the experience, get all their training. We cover some of their college costs for their EMS stuff, for EMT licenses. We have somebody actually earlier this year that was hired by Salem. We have somebody that's leaving us in this fall to go to Gresham. And then we have somebody that just left us recently to go to Hermiston. So we do have that mix where we see a lot of people come in and push forward through their EMS and get their paramedic licenses and then push on to a bigger department. And we absolutely love to see that with the younger crew that comes in here. That's kind of what we pride ourselves into. Like, hey, we want to push them through training. We want to push them in the field.
Yeah.
Yeah. To get them out there.
How did the, I'd love to hear more about the community of Colton and how you felt like the community supported you guys through the wildfire experience.
I don't think I've ever seen a community come together like this one has. Mm-hmm. The support, the donations, the food, the just the people waving and honking, the signs on the side of the road, yeah, even
saw,
still.
Yeah. I saw some of them out here.
So the support was unbelievable. It just like gives you a chill and makes you emotional to see that. My wife's family is from out here, and so there's tie to the community that I have through them. And it's been amazing. Yeah. I do all the Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, all that stuff. And to see that reaction coming in from like the first week of the fire, where we were getting, 40,000 views on a video, which I mean is unheard of for this area.
Yeah.
You know, you could go back through some of the videos and it's like 500 views, 600 views, 40,000. It's like, whoa, you know?
Yeah.
So, but just the support from the people in this community has been amazing.
Mm-hmm. You know, obviously I don't know what things look like out here in Colton, but, obviously it's a difficult time for a lot of people. There's some division and divisiveness. You feel like, some of that got torn down a little bit, you know, when you talk about things coming together.
I do. I think, you know, out here, there is a mix of kind of the bedroom community for people that just live here and work in the metro. And then there's the people that are anchored out here that farm and log. And so sometimes you do feel a little rub and give in between them two groups of people.
Sure.
But I think the last month has been amazing. And I think there was some healing done, I think, with all the divisiveness that there is right now in the world. I think it was good.
So how big is Colton? How big is the Colton Fire District?
So we're a 46 square mile. We kind of sit in between Malala and Estacada. We do a lot of mutual aids with both sides of the district. All our ambulance service comes from Malala. So it's good. We have the highway, so we do see our fair share of high speed crashes.
Sure.
Because we have the highway that splits our district right down in. And we have about 35 volunteers total. And like I said, we have a really good mix of age. We have a really good mix of in-district and out-of-district people. So like tonight, Friday night at the firehouse, right? There's three of us, four of us on shift. Three aren't paid. And then the duty officer gets a stipend for being here for his shift. So we have an engine tonight, and then we have the duty officer tonight. So that's kind of a normal weekend thing. The first, after the first week settled down of the fires, we staffed two rigs or three rigs some nights for a week straight on top of what we did for before the conflagration was called. So they were kind of using our station as a hub for this area. And then, so we had to have somebody here 24 hours to monitor the radio, make sure, because we were still responding to calls, even though we were still at a level three evacuation for almost our entire district. Obviously there's some people that just won't leave. And then we have to kind of stand at the ready for the hotshot crews in case they have something happen. And then we have to kind of go out and get them and package them up or whatever the medical issue may be. So we held down the fort here after they determined and called the conflagration really late Thursday night, that first Friday, early Friday morning, that first week. And then they started bringing in some more structural assets to protect houses, which is kind of the mode we were in all week. There really wasn't nothing we were going to do on the Riverside fire with the head of that fire coming at us as hard as it was. We kind of just held it at bay on the two sides that we could. And kept it down in the river valley.
Even Unger, I mean, when I first came out here, you guys were on a call.
We'll
talk about that in a second. But I saw some of that, and that was very close to Colton and large. I mean, obviously not nowhere near the side of the Riverside, but a very large fire. I guess, I mean, people must have been scared that, like, town of Colton could be wiped off the map, right?
Right. Well, that's kind of the way they were. They were talking early about that being kind of like the Beachy Creek fire and the Riverside fire coming to head here is kind of the way it was kind of looking for a little while.
Yeah.
Until the weather shifted on us. Yeah.
Oh man.
So Thursday afternoon.
And that would have been.
It would have been.
Yeah.
Not good. Yeah. It looked like Detroit Lake.
Yeah.
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 So they did that tactical pause Thursday afternoon and pulled everybody out, put us on in the safety zones, kind of scattered around the area.
Yeah.
Just to get us away from the heads of the fire. And they had a meteorologist with the IC team was saying, hey, we got to pay attention to this. Mm-hmm. Like, this could not be good.
Yeah.
And so they made the decision in the IC in, I don't know where, I think they were in Clackamas at the time, and said, nope, get everybody out for a little while and take a pause. I think we sat for a couple hours and then went back to work.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so it was interesting to hear that radio call. I've never heard something like that on the radio.
To pull back.
To they sent out emergency tones and said, this is a, you know, it's a column driven fire and everybody needs to get out and tell people on your way out, they need to leave too. Like it was just kind of, it was eye opening to hear that and just be like, you kind of look around and you look at the crew and you look at the other engine company we were standing there with and everybody kind of went,
yeah,
what is did this? That really just happen? Like, is that, did we just hear the same thing?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And so they pull us out and we hung out in a field on the edge, just on the edge of Colton for a couple hours with, I think there was, you know, 30 fire engines kind of huddled up together. Yeah. And they brought us out to lunch really quick and just said, you know, take a breather. And they were kind of waiting for it to blow up and have us do some spot fire chasing, you know, just and then going back to home protection.
Yeah.
And it never happened, thank goodness. I mean, we were all grateful for it because the weather kind of shifted so that afternoon. That
pause was a little bit of they thought something bad was going to happen.
Yeah, so they thought what was going to happen is the fires were going to merge and then it's a plume dominated fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes its own weather system.
Right.
And they were worried about the plume hitting the freezing level. And then they weren't really sure what was going to happen.
Yeah.
So they've seen it in the past where the plumes have fallen and they've just, it was doing some things they weren't expecting it to do. So they just took that pause and for everybody's safety and said, hey, we need to pump the brakes here and let's just make sure we got everybody accounted for and we're good.
Yeah.
And see what it does.
Well, that's good to know because I know a lot of us non-firefighters were experiencing things that we had never experienced before. So it's nice to know we weren't alone.
Yeah, no, we never left the district. I know that was kind of a big thing on Facebook and kind of around the social media circles. Everybody was really worried that we'd just kind of abandon everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that never had happened. We kind of took another reassess late Wednesday night, about midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of grouped everybody up at the high school, made some new task forces, and then spread everybody else out because they were kind of expecting it the Wednesday night into Thursday, and then it pushed it into Thursday. And I don't think the fires ever met.
Yeah.
As far as the heads of the fires, I think the plume met together at one point, but we got lucky with the weather.
You guys did lose some homes, unfortunately.
I don't think our fire district itself lost any homes.
Okay, good.
So our neighboring district lost a couple on the Unger fire, and then there were some homes lost on the Riverside fire. But I don't even know what the final count was, if they even have a final count yet.
Yeah. And now, I mean, so we're now a few weeks past it. But like I said, when I got here, you weren't here. I didn't chase you down. Out to Unger, because there's still hot spots and still kindlings coming up.
Yeah, so we're
firing a stump,
chasing stump fires. We're going on about, I would say we're averaging 5 or 6 a day right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want people to call those in, let us know, hey, we're seeing something. But the fire, when it burns hot like that in the trees, it gets into the root systems of the trees and burns into the ground. And so you hear about the wild end hotshot guys talking about cold trailing. Mm-hmm. So they literally take their gloves off and feel the ground for any warm spots all the way around the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why those guys are the unsung heroes of this stuff, because they go out 16 hours a day, a couple weeks at a time, take a couple days off and go right back to it. And
if they find a hot spot, there will literally be fire under the ground.
Yeah, so they have to dig it up. and put it out. Because
it's burning a piece of a root.
Yeah, so it burns in, like the tree stump that you saw us on this afternoon was hollow inside. So it had burned the inside, and then it gets into the roots. Well, it burns through the roots. Mm-hmm. So as the tree grows into the ground, it tunnels the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that fire can live in there and smolder for months, which they saw up the gorge fire, you know, in the springtime. They're still going, right?
This would be a thing. Yeah.
They're still going out on smoking fires in the springtime, which I'm sure we will have some of them.
Yeah.
With just the Unger fire ended up being almost five, I think it was 497 acres.
Yeah.
And it's all timber. I mean, that's what's great about Colton is we're surrounded by timber.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. But dangerous.
It is very dangerous when something like that happens.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Well, we'll wrap things up here. Obviously, we're still pretty close, probably, you know, things are obviously quieted down, fortunately, a little bit from the peak. Probably had a little bit of time to reflect. Do you have any distance or any sort of context, just kind of final thoughts when you look back at that craziness of just what you think will stick with you?
I think the biggest thing that will stick is the generosity of people of other fire districts. Aurora Fire, oh my gosh, those guys opened their station up to us Thursday night. Mm-hmm. So when they finally decided it was a conflagration call and pulled all of us off the line Thursday night, early Friday morning, our guys took kind of a breather for that 8 hours. Mm-hmm. And Aurora opened up, they emptied their station, said, hey, you guys, come in here. We got hot food. We have showers. We have sleeping bags. The Aurora community showed up with cots and sleeping bags and brand new pillows and more stuff than you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
And their chief over there put the call out and it's like, hey, we're going to host Colton. And we stayed there for, I think, 3 or 4 days. Wow. We had guys living, some of our guys that were evacuated were living in their, one of their houses they have. We had a couple of people in RVs on their training grounds. Mm-hmm. Like, just here you go. Opened up their home for us, and it was amazing. So the generosity of people coming together from not only Colton, but the surrounding Estacada, Molalla, Aurora, which you wouldn't even have thought. Yeah, it was amazing to see.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And Aurora's even a different county. So
that was just the generosity of that department is amazing. And then they gave one of their old fire engines to Detroit.
Yeah. That was an amazing story. Yeah.
The chief over there is something special, that guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Well, Chris, thank you so much for taking time out. Obviously, you know, this is something that we'll all be talking about for a long time. So
that's the truth.
Yeah. Appreciate telling us a little bit of the story that we hadn't heard.
Thank you very much for coming out.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with 3 realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate and we got in a carriage ride with the horse and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months. Sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life.
Mm-hmm. How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
For Police Beat this week, we're sharing some of the recent goings-on from the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. So let's get started. A Portland man was arrested last week for allegedly setting fire to several vehicles at a car dealership in Milwaukee. Wesley Samuel Clore, 26 years old, was arrested in the incident after employees said he had threatened to burn down the car lot the previous day. Clackamas County deputies responded to the report of a fire at Brooks Motor Company on Southeast McLaughlin Boulevard shortly before 1 a.m. Wednesday. Deputies arrived to find multiple vehicles ablaze in the secured lot of the car dealership. Clackamas Fire District and Gladstone Fire arrived to extinguish the blazes. The vehicles had been marked for sale, and most of them were parked next to each other in a line in the center of the car lot, police said. Two additional vehicles were set on fire under a covered roof structure on the lot that was also damaged. Deputies contacted the owner and an employee who said a male customer in a wheelchair, later identified as Clore, had threatened to torch the dealership the previous afternoon and had allegedly thrown a skateboard at an employee and threatened to slit their throat. As the investigation continued, deputies noticed a man in a wheelchair watching from across the street. It turned out to be Wesley Clore. Deputies made contact and said the man smelled strongly of accelerant. A search revealed items corresponding to evidence found at the arson scene, police said, as well as a Halloween mask. Clore was arrested and booked into Clackamas County Jail on charges of second-degree arson and first-degree criminal mischief. Bail is set for $40,000. Also on Wednesday, the Sheriff Police bid farewell to pioneering female detective Lisa Shipley, who retired after 26 years in law enforcement, most recently with the CCSO's new Adult Sex Crimes Unit based at a Safe Place Justice Center in Oregon City. Her amazing career began at the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office in Eureka, California in 1984, working part-time in their jail. She went full-time in 1987 and was hired as a patrol duty deputy. She joined the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office as a patrol deputy in 1994. She went on to make detective, serving on the child abuse team and on the homicide and violent crimes unit. Among her colleagues, Shipley is known as a major presence in the CCSO's in-house gym, leading high-intensity interval training workouts that include blasting up and down the department's four flights of stairs several days a week. On Friday, the Sheriff's Office assisted Hoodland Fire and Oregon State Police with a fire vehicle in the afternoon on Highway 26 in Government Camp. The fire involved propane tanks that were venting and ammunition that ignited. Fortunately, there were no injuries. Highway 26 was closed in both directions for about 30 minutes while emergency workers dealt with the fire. A woman was arrested after leading Clackamas County deputies on a short pursuit in a motorhome along Interstate 205 Thursday morning. The sheriff's office said a deputy attempted to stop the RV for traffic violations at around 10 a.m., but the female driver did not stop and led the police on a brief pursuit. The CCSO deployed spike strips to slow the motorhome down, and it stopped on I-205 southbound near 213 exit in Oregon City. Deputies used their patrol vehicles to block in the vehicle after it came to a stop. The sheriff's office said it took deputies about 15 minutes to convince the suspect to exit the vehicle. Once she was outside, she was taken into custody without incident. The suspect, whose name has not yet been released, will be booked for attempt to elude, police said. On Saturday, deputies assisted Clackamas Fire and American Medical Response personnel when a 60-year-old man fell 40 to 50 feet down an embankment and struck his head near Estacada. Crews used a high point and rope system to pull the patient up the steep slope. He was flown by Life Flight to an area trauma center for treatment. Highway 224 was blocked for about an hour and reopened at 7:30 p.m. Finally, we saved the best for last. Four young men were arrested outside Malala early one morning last week for being caught with hundreds of pounds of stolen hemp plants, which the suspects mistakenly believed to be recreational marijuana. Talk about a half-baked scheme, not to be too blunt. Both hemp and marijuana are forms of cannabis, but only marijuana contains intoxicating quantities of THC. Hemp is grown commercially for a variety of other products, including CBD oil, which was the case here. At 3:22 a.m. Tuesday, the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office and Molalla Police responded to a report of multiple subjects walking on Highway 211 near South Palmer Road outside of Molalla. Authorities soon located the four male suspects. They were loaded down with large bags and high expectations. Green leaves protruding from the bags, as well as the suspect's pants and jacket pockets. One was carrying an armful of hemp plants itself. Police said the suspects were wearing dark clothing and were caked in mud. One attempted to throw the duffel bag he was carrying down the embankment when the Clackamas County deputy switched on his lights. Authorities say they were all laden with large quantities of hemp plants, anywhere from 60 to 80 pounds each. An on-scene investigation quickly revealed that the four suspects had stolen the plants from a nearby legal grow operation off of 211. The four had heard about the farm from a friend and had reportedly taken a bus from Portland to Molalla to steal the plants, thinking they were recreational marijuana. Perhaps the friend was just blowing smoke. Sure sounds like it. The owner of the farm arrived and identified the plants as hemp, used mostly for therapeutic CBD oils and containing only a minimal amount of THC. The plants were nevertheless valued at around $2,500 and were returned to the owner. The suspects were transported to Clackamas County Jail and booked without incident. They faced charges of first-degree theft and criminal trespass. For photos and dash cam video of the incident, find this story on our website, canbefirst.com.
B14068N7040.
Hey, Frankie, what are you doing?
Well, I was trying to win this direct link pattern bingo game. That Hallmark gift basket is as good as mine.
Direct link bingo game?
You bet. Our local internet provider is hosting a virtual bingo game to show appreciation for their members. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, super cool. Who does that?
Direct link does. They miss seeing their members during these difficult times and wanted to offer a fun way to stay engaged and win some sweet prizes.
They really do work hard to embody that cooperative spirit, don't they?
Well, October is Cooperative Month, and DirectLink is a cooperative that was started back in 1904 by local farmers, so bingo kind of makes sense. They are one of roughly 260 remaining communications co-ops in the U.S. who provide connections over 40% of the land so that more than 50 million rural Americans have the technology that they need to thrive.
Well, that's pretty unique. So how does bingo work?
DirectLink members were mailed a bingo card at the beginning of September. Simply visit directlink.coop/bingo or DirectLink Facebook page every weekday to get that day's bingo number and cross it off your card. They're playing four different simultaneous games, with the blackout prize being a four-pack of tickets to a 2021 Mariners game.
Okay, wow. Get out of my way. I gotta go get my card right now.
Good luck, you know, on everything except that Hallmark basket, because, like I said, that's mine.
Now Hear This, Canby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This, Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.